Here's another inspiring speech recorded at Communities in Control, Australia's biggest and best annual community sector gathering.
Thank you for that very generous introduction. And I'm really delighted and honored to have been selected as the fourth International Pratt Fellow at this very stimulating meeting. And I'm pleased to be here in part because I know of no equivalent gathering anywhere in the world where so many community groups and policymakers, church leaders, business folks all come together and share a vision of the power of community for improving health and well-being. I am deeply grateful to Rhonda, to Dennis Moriarty, to Father Joe for their leadership in making this conference come together, and of course to Carol Schwartz and the other social entrepreneurs who got behind the idea of One Our Community and then also this conference. I have to confess though that as an American brought to Australia to address your conference theme, I feel like a bit of an imposter because your country is way ahead of mine in many, many ways in terms of showing the community, showing the world the meaning of healthy communities and of high-level community participation. And John, I thought, illustrated that beautifully in his talk. Here in Victoria, and I hope we still have the clicker. Okay. The Environments for Health Framework, I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with this because it comes out of public health, but this is, I think, one of the best documents I've ever seen for promoting true intersectoral planning for public health through a heavy accent on community involvement. And similarly, the Community Manifesto that grew out of the first Communities in Control Conference is a visionary blueprint for action whose reach goes well beyond Australia. Ever since I discovered this document, I've been quoting it widely. So while I'll share today some examples from the United States and elsewhere of the power of community groups and of community-based action research, I do so with considerable humility, knowing that I've already learned a lot more from you folks than I can ever hope to share. The theme of your conference, though, challenging the power of one, couldn't be more timely. For despite a thriving international healthy cities movement and numerous examples in Australia and around the world of the value of community-based work, the individual remains the focus of our health and social services, and to a large extent, of much of what gets done in the name of improving wellness and human well-being. In my own field of public health, the core discipline of epidemiology has increasingly focused its gaze on individual risk factors for disease, things like cholesterol, smoking, unsafe sex. And I think there's a cartoon that goes with this, but it hasn't popped up yet. Do I dare click it again? Yes. Can you read this in the back? This guy is ticking off all the good things he's done for his health. He's lowered his cholesterol, given up smoking, cut out alcohol, and he's still about to be clobbered because there's been no attention to the broader social or community environment. As my colleague and your former Pratt Fellow points out, while well-intentioned, this kind of risk factor approach is almost beside the point. Lowering cholesterol may be good for an individual, but it does nothing to address the fact that cholesterol levels remain high in the population. Getting a smoker to quit is great, and people like Rhonda have done an unreal job in changing the whole climate in this country. And yet, it doesn't help for us to work one by one on the individual smoker if we've still got, as we do in our country, though thanks to Rhonda and others, not in yours, the targeting of youth in advertisement like this. This is just deplorable. So that you have new kids taking up the habit the minute the first person quits. So among the overarching themes of your conference are things like how do we reframe health and social issues so that community and society and not the lone individual become the primary focus of our efforts? How do we convincingly demonstrate and showcase the role that community groups and partnerships are playing to improve health and well-being? And how do we truly put communities in control? Although I can't begin to do justice to these topics, I do want to suggest one avenue that I think may be very helpful as we think about them, and that involves demonstrating the powerful role of community groups in studying and addressing health problems through community-based action research. Now, the importance of broadening our gaze in this way really can't be overstressed, because whether we are working here in Melbourne or in Sao Paulo or Cape Town or Hyderabad or San Francisco, the complexity of many of our health and social problems make them very poorly suited to traditional, outside expert-driven research and the often disappointing interventions that it has helped to spawn. And community members are calling on this, they're calling us on this. They're pointing up what they see as this huge disconnect between the real concerns of citizens and community groups and what we outsiders end up studying and working on. Well, together, this kind of force has led to a burgeoning of interest in an alternative paradigm that goes by many names, but that has as its centerpiece three interrelated elements: participation, research, and action. And when we effectively bring these three elements together, we have a powerful tool for moving forward the agenda of your Communities in Control conference. My favorite definition of what here in Australia is called action research describes it as a collaborative process that equitably involves all partners in the research and really recognizes their unique strengths. It begins with a research topic of importance to the community, not the outside researcher, and it combines knowledge and action for social change to improve health and well-being and to eliminate the kinds of disparities we've heard talked about by so many of the speakers at this conference. Robin McTaggart at Scotland, I think he was formerly here in Australia, has outlined a number of core principles for this kind of approach, the idea that it is political, that it involves people, lay people in theory making, that it's committed to improving social action or social practice by changing it and establishing self-critical communities. My colleague Barbara Israel argues that this research also involves some of the other principles, the idea that this research involves co-learning. It's not just you guys learning from the outside experts, but us learning a tremendous amount from you. It's about community capacity building, as John said, and it's about balancing research and action. And I would add that real action research has to embody a commitment to cultural humility. I love this definition and I love this term, cultural humility, the idea that we can't ever be competent in another's culture, but we can demonstrate a commitment to self-reflection and openness to others' cultures and a commitment to respectful partnership. That's what it's all about. And finally, good action research carefully attends to issues of validity, not only in the traditional sense that researchers mean, but also in the sense of taking a step back to say, hey, is this research question valid? Does this come from or make sense to or matter to the local community? And that point is particularly important because, as sociologist John McKinley points out, professionals suffer from this very unfortunate malady that he called terminal hardening of the categories. He said, we get the kind of answers that we're comfortable dealing with because we ask the questions that will give us those answers. What happens when community groups actually set the research agenda, or at minimum have a real role in helping determine what gets studied and the kinds of interventions that get developed? Well, for one thing, as John mentioned, we're much more likely to address issues that matter to communities. Professor Mogboiva Moseval in South Africa learned this lesson early on when he started designing a study to look at risk factors for cervical cancer, huge high rates of cervical cancer in South Africa. his country. And to his credit, before he went too far, he and his fellow researchers partnered with a group of community women. And the women said, no. They said, if you're going to make this relevant to us, you broaden what you're looking at. They said, HIV/AIDS, domestic violence, poverty, these necessitate a far broader topic, a far broader framing of the issue. So it wasn't cervical cancer, it was cervical health. I think even that term is a little narrow for what they were getting at, but they managed to change the whole research agenda by being involved. Action research then stresses community control in defining what we study, but it also reflects another major theme of your conference in having us move from a deficit mentality view of communities as a bundle of pathologies to instead look at developing a community of, or an epidemiology of strengths. Now, some of you, I suspect, are familiar with the work of John McKnight and John Kretzmann at Northwestern, who gave us what they called asset-based community development, or ABCD for short. Their idea was that rather than simply doing community needs assessments, where we go out there and look for problems, we collaboratively map the capacities of communities, particularly low-income communities. And they divide these capacities into primary building blocks, things like a neighborhood's, things under a neighborhood's control, and that would be the capacity of local leaders, indigenous leaders, the talents of local residents, community groups, churches, cultural organizations. And then the secondary building blocks. These are the things that are physically in the neighborhood, but that are largely controlled by outsiders. And these might be public schools or parks or vacant land. And then once inventoried, these are all used by community groups in a capacity-oriented planning process. I saw this approach at work most powerfully in the low-income, mostly minority community in and around Richmond, California. And I skipped over my lovely introductory slide. They just got a logo. I was determined to show it to you. Okay, there they are. Anyway, the local health department had messed up royally. They'd gone in and tried to deal with smoking, and smoking wasn't an issue in this community. The intervention fell flat on its face. And so they went in with a more humble approach. They partnered with some community groups and said, could we start an effort to find out what you guys care about and then help you as you address those issues? Well, they started out by having the local community groups help them identify who the informal leaders were in this community. And these are the kinds of questions that you can ask to do this. Things like, when you have a problem, who do you go to for advice? When others have a problem, who do they go to? When the community has had a problem, who's come together to help address it? Who have been the movers and shakers? And a question I love, what do people tell you you're good at? Through this method, they came up with eight residents who were named over and over again and who they trained and hired as community organizers, and more than 80 who were hired and trained as neighborhood health advocates. And in turn, these made up neighborhood action teams. Well, part of their training involved learning some health content, learning how to see health in a broader systems perspective, but they also were taught skills in action research, things like what this young man is doing, asset mapping, where you go around a community and really take note of what the good things are, what is it that you can build on if you're going to do some work in that community. They learned survey research. They also went through exercises like this. Now again, these are people that are recognized by their neighbors as having some leadership skill or being people that are trusted locally, but they walk into a room for this first meeting, this first training, they're nervous as heck. You know, they have no idea why they're here. And so what the trainers did was they put up big pieces of paper on the wall and they had labels, things like cooking for large groups, childcare, non-English speaking ability. Well, everybody that walked into the room could sign in under one of those skill areas and start to feel good about themselves. And I have to say, in my state right now, framing non-English speaking ability as a strength rather than a liability was huge. It's a terribly important thing to do. So they did this sort of thing. And then they trained the community organizers and the neighborhood health advocates to go around the neighborhood and lead literally dozens of residents, including youth, in walking through the community, noting the assets that they saw, noting the problems they saw, and then coming together and putting on this is a community map where they all put with different color push pins what they'd identify in terms of resources and strengths. Then they conducted a door-to-door survey. They interviewed 500 residents, finding out what people liked best about the neighborhood, what they thought the problems were. And they helped the health department folks then analyze the findings. Again, it was recognized that their lay knowledge gave them a lot of insight into what the data they collected was actually telling. They held a community forum where people prioritized their top goals based on the mapping and the interviews, and then went to work to address their number one issue, which was getting speed bumps in the neighborhood, slowing down those fast cars that are usually involved in drugs or in other kinds of activity that's not so positive. They wanted to get speed bumps, and because I always tell my students the four most important words in community organizing are refreshments will be served. It really works. The first thing they did when they got the speed bumps was to have those refreshments, have a party. Any excuse to have a party is a good idea in community work. Well, this neighborhood health project has had a number of important outcomes. In addition to getting speed bumps in a community center, they got evening and night bus service restored in an area that had been without. They got a defunct tenants organization in one of the housing projects back into action, and they helped them write and get a $100,000 grant for a job training program. They got improved lighting. They got a soccer team for youth. And years after that failed effort to mobilize the community around tobacco, the neighborhood health advocates took it on themselves to get a very offensive tobacco ad targeting minority youth out of that community. The project created a mural capturing their vision of a healthy community, and 40 youth took great pride in painting it in under the direction of a local artist. They also created a bucket brigade. I don't know if you have these here, but I know you've got an asthma problem in Australia just as we do, and this is a way that local community people can literally trap the air and be able to look at what the dangers are in terms of their exposure. So they created this bucket brigade. People got involved in city and regional decision making. Lots of changes going on. Now the problem is it's very difficult to determine the specific contributions of a project like this to individual and health outcomes because so many different programs are operating simultaneously. But the evaluator did show increased participation in a new child health program in participating neighborhoods, and they also saw increased feelings of empowerment, increased sense of control, which we know are terribly important intermediate outcomes that in turn can contribute to other health and social outcomes down the line. And I wanted to be sure and mention one of the tools that was used in this regard. It's something any of you can use in your community work. I got permission to put this in the appendix to our book, but it's available elsewhere. It's a series of items developed by Barbara Israel and her colleagues at Michigan. Things like, I can influence decisions that affect my life. My community group or organization can affect those decisions that affect our neighborhood. And by working together, my neighborhood can influence decisions that affect our community. Well, as Dr. Syme suggested in his inaugural Pratt lecture, there's a lot of evidence now that sense of control is critical to health and well-being. So if we can show that our community groups, our community-based action research partnerships are contributing to sense of control, that's a major achievement. Another strength, though, of research that's done with rather than on communities is that it helps us design locally tailored interventions that can make a real difference in community health and well-being. And I wanted to give you an example. In both Australia and the United States, obesity rates, as you know, have doubled over the last couple of decades. And in both our countries, lots of factors are contributing to this. The United States has been called an autoerotic society. When you think about it, all too often our communities are designed with cars, not people, in mind. Where's the incentive to go for a walk when you take your life in your hands anytime you do? Now, to be sure, individual choices have a role of this. We all know of people, my 14-year-old among them, who would much rather forego the baseball game and the bike ride to exercise their thumbs, as I'm trying to do now. There they are. You know, they sit indoors and they say, "Mom, I just got 20 shots in a row." And I say, "Yeah, but you're doing it with your thumbs. Go outside and do it with the ball." Anyway, this is a problem. We've got, on all levels, individuals making unhealthy choices. We know that. We also know that while people are doing the Game Boys and the computer stuff, they're munching the chips and they're downing the sodas. And I wanted to put this slide in a 20-ounce can of soda these days, 17 teaspoons of sugar. I was shocked to discover this, 17 teaspoons. In our country, and I was told also in yours, about 15% of all the calories consumed by our teenagers are from sodas, period, just sodas. Well, younger kids, too, are bombarded with ads for unhealthy snacks. Kellogg Corporation spent $32 million recently in a deal with Nickelodeon to get SpongeBob SquarePants on their packages of Cheez-Its. Now, they're being sued over this, but nevertheless, they got away with it. We all know about these and other societal forces contributing to things like the obesity epidemic, and some of them do require work on the national level. And I was delighted when Dennis drove me in from the airport. I pointed out the first thing I saw was a McDonald's, and he said, "Yes, but Australia was the first country to demand that McDonald's start offering healthy food in addition to French fries." So, you know, we do these kinds of things. Our former president, Bill Clinton, you may remember Bill. anyway, Bill recently engineered a soda ban in all American public schools. We're thrilled. And I have to say, doesn't Bill look good in retrospect? Take a look at Bill. Okay. I was told I was among friends and I could say some little anti-Bush. Okay. So anyway, we do need action on a national level. We need leaders who are going to take steps like this. But local community groups can also help us understand specific factors in their neighborhood that may be contributing to a problem like obesity, and whether and how local social capital can be marshaled to help design an intervention that can make a difference. And I wanted to give you a couple of quick examples. Bayview Hunters Point, neighborhood in San Francisco, always in the newspaper because of homicide, lots of toxic emissions from oil refineries. And yet, when a community youth group, Literacy for Environmental Justice, partnered with the health department and did a survey in their community to find out what the key issues were, one of the top ones nobody thought of, it was food insecurity. It was the kind of thing we heard of from one of the community idol finalists, the Wunan group, where the grocery stores leave town. It's not in their best interest to stay in an indigenous area, or in this case, an inner city area with lots of African Americans and Hispanics who don't have as much money. They all take off, and you're left with these little stores that sell a lot of packaged food and alcohol and tobacco, but very little in the way of healthy food. Well, when they discovered this, the youth from Ledge were trained to do store shelf diagramming. They went into these little stores and they measured how much space was devoted to the different kinds of food. And here's what they found: 11 stores, almost 40% of what was available for the whole neighborhood was packaged food, 26% of the space went to alcohol and cigarettes, 17% to sodas, and that tiny magenta little sliver there is the 2% available to fresh fruits and vegetables. Well, the youth also conducted surveys with local residents to find out what it would take to get them to shop locally instead of going out of town. They interviewed the local merchants to find out what it would take to get them to take down those tobacco and alcohol ads and to get them to allocate more space to healthy food alternatives. And working with another community group and some local politicians, particularly this one, if we can find her here, who is pictured as an eggplant, great politician. Anyway, they got the city to make some concessions where they were going to make a number of benefits available to the stores that would agree to provide healthy alternatives. They called it the healthy neighborhood, the good neighbor program. And so if you agreed that you would sell more fresh fruits and vegetables, you'd get things like discounted loans and energy efficient appliances from the city. The first store to adopt this new program reported an increase in the sales of fresh fruits and vegetables from 5% to 15% in the first 7 months. There was a decrease in alcohol sales from 25% to 15%. And recently, five more stores in the neighborhood have signed up to become good neighbors, and now building on their success, they are actually partnering with business leaders and policymakers to pass a state law that would extend this program throughout California. Again, all this work grew out of a local community youth group, and they're partnering with a local health department and later with government and business to study and address what they saw as a big cause of the obesity problem in their neighborhood. Well, let's look quickly at another community. This one, a small rural town. It's called Newcastle. It's not your Newcastle, but ours in the middle of the country, where a healthy communities group teamed up with outside researchers to study their health situation. They did a randomized survey of almost 500 residents. They discussed the results at a town hall meeting, and they realized that a big cause of their high obesity rate was that this town was so spread out, people were totally dependent on cars, and that was a big part of the problem. So the Healthy Communities Group mobilized the town. They got young people and old, they got Boy Scout troops, they even had prisoners who were allowed to come out of prison and work on this, to build a network of walking and biking and wheeling trails lined with 5,000 trees that they planted and that connected schools, churches, stores, the YMCA. They then worked with several municipal departments to get permission to rebuild a deteriorating public park. 1,200 residents turned out for 1 week. They gave up jobs, gave up everything else, and just came together to build a playground for the youth and a surrounding park. And today, 10 years after that original partnership took place, they are again hard at work. Most recently, they're negotiating with government and some business partners to buy this old wrought iron bridge, which is being torn down. They want to place that bridge over a major highway that divides their community in two and stops people from walking, biking, wheeling around town. And incidentally, when I go home, I'm going to suggest to them that they follow Victoria's example with the walking school bus, which I think would catch on in this little town. Well, I've spent most of my time talking about the promise of community partnerships. And here in Australia, where you've got your 700,000 community groups and many government partners, business leaders, university folks, you've got giant supporters like our community and like the Pratt Foundation, understanding the power of collaborative partnerships, I think the time is ideal for moving further in the direction of these partnerships. But Rhonda asked me to also address some of the challenges posed in this work, and particularly how we can demonstrate that community groups and partnerships really are making a difference. So let me turn just very quickly to a few of the ethical challenges that arise in this work, and then some of the special challenges in proving that the work that all of you are doing really makes a difference. One of the big challenges we face, of course, is that there are real power imbalances. There are differential reward structures in our partnerships. Those of us who are the outside professionals often stand to gain a lot more. We get the grants, the publications, et cetera. It goes on our resume that we've brought in money for this project. And community groups are expected to work for a lot less money or no money on a timetable that may not mesh with their needs and concerns. We also know from a study in Sydney of participation in resident action groups One of the things that they were able to show is that participation in resident action groups, one of the best ways to increase participation is decreasing member costs. Well, you do this partly, obviously, by helping subsidize transportation or providing childcare, but you also do it by making sure that the community members who are often in the position of being outsiders within when they work with us researchers don't, in the words of the Brazilian educator Paulo Freire, become strangers in their own community. We often put our community folks out to do the dirty work. You tell them that they might be in the control group and they might not get the benefit of this intervention. That's a heck of a thing to do to your community partners, and it's done all the time. To address these and other potential difficulties before they arrive, tribes and other groups of indigenous people in Australia, New Zealand, the United States, and Canada have all developed beautiful ethical guidelines for their collaborative work, including protocols that address things like negotiating with political and spiritual leaders in the community to obtain their input and approval. Ensuring equitable benefits to participants. Are we providing training? Are we hiring them in return for their contributions? Developing agreements about the ownership and the publication of findings. And in both Indigenous communities and the disability community with which I've worked a fair amount, the maxim, nothing about us without us, has been critical to fostering community control of the research process. As your community manifesto points out, that means in part making sure that community groups and study participants have an authentic role in deciding how findings are going to be used and what to do if findings emerge that could cast the community in an unflattering light. This is one of the tough ethical issues that Rob Travers and Sarah Flicker in Toronto deal with in an online workshop on ethical issues for community-based research. And I wanted to recommend their website, wellesleycentral.com, which is very useful in letting you find this and use it with your community group as you talk about some of these tough issues. There's another one you may want to look at the Royal Society of Canada website. Larry Green and his colleagues in British Columbia developed a whole series of questions that we can use, again, in partnership with all the different stakeholders we're working with, to figure out in advance and along the way how we're dealing with these difficult ethical issues that come up. But at the same time that we're dealing with all of these issues, we do need to be mindful of Rhonda's other challenge, namely to show, to document how community groups and their partnerships are having an effect on health and social outcomes. And this is tough. It's tough because the continually evolving nature of the community work we do, the very complex environments in which it takes place, and the fact that these efforts often seek changes on multiple levels at the same time make many traditional evaluation approaches really tough. They just don't work well for our kind of work. We know, too, that changes in things like health status may take years to detect, especially in a form that we can then attribute to a particular community group's effort or intervention. So it's vital that we focus in part on documenting what the changes are in shorter-term system-level indicators that also are critical to our work. We need to ask things like, and there's a typo there, did our community group or project result in increased social networks? Did it increase community participation? Did it increase individual sense of control? How about sense of hope for the future, particularly if we're working with youth? There are hope scales where you can actually measure whether kids are feeling more hopeful now than when your project began. Did it result in new policies or practices that in turn can impact on individual health and well-being down the line? Now, we can document some of these things in numerical form using tools like that perceived control scale that I mentioned earlier. But as John McKnight always likes to remind us, while institutions learn from studies and statistics, people learn from stories. In fact, a line I love is that statistics are people with the tears washed off. And we mustn't forget to collect and tell the stories and write up and publish the case studies that show the impact of our community groups, our community partnerships, and the differences they're making in the lives of real people. So mindful of this, I want to close by sharing a story that was one of my most poignant lessons in the power of community. When I was first teaching, a group of my students became concerned about the high rates of social isolation and physical and mental health problems among the low-income, elderly, and disabled residents of San Francisco's Tenderloin hotels. You might tell in Australia, where there's no cooking allowed and the bathrooms are down the hall and shared by many people, it's a very hard way to live. Residents weren't allowed to cook in their room, but they would hook up these illegal hot plates in order to live. And they lived in a neighborhood where it was 2 crimes per person per year. Just amazing. You know, you don't go out and walk for exercise when you're likely to get mugged. It's just not good for your health. Well, we began by starting hotel-based support groups and tenant associations through which residents could study and address health problems that they collectively identified. And we started out in 6 hotels, eventually got up to 24. And we started a nonprofit called the Tenderloin Senior Organizing Project to help oversee all of this work. Not surprisingly, when we went into hotel after hotel and the students would ask, what issues do you want to deal with? Crime was number one. That was their health issue they wanted to address. The students in those days said, well, crime's not a health problem. They say, oh, yes. If we're mugged, we can't go out for exercise, we can't keep a doctor appointment, we can't do anything. It's our health problem. So the students listened, helped them organize on this issue. They, to make a long story short, they called a community-wide meeting on the subject of crime. They got the media to publicize that meeting. They formed an inter-hotel coalition called Tenderloin Tenants for Safer Streets, demanded and got a meeting with the mayor, then Senator Feinstein. They increased the number of beat patrol officers in the neighborhood, and they organized to get over 100 businesses in the neighborhood. And these are, you know, these are massage parlors and not the kind of businesses we normally think about. But they got those places to put signs in their windows to be safe houses where people could go if they were being followed or if they just needed help getting to the bank on the day their check came in. And the police chief later gave them credit for much of the huge drop in crime. They had a 26% drop in crime in the first 18 months of their work, and the police chief arrived and said, this is thanks to you guys. Well, we knew it was partly because it was a very wet couple of years, and muggers don't come out in the rain, but it didn't matter. They felt terrifically empowered that the police chief was giving them credit. The residents then turned their attention to nutrition. They started hotel-based mini-markets in the hotels where people could get access to fresh fruits and vegetables. They started a cooperative breakfast program to qualify for a food bank. One I loved, they tested recipes for a no-cook cookbook. I'm trying to find this for you, yes. They wrote to people like the San Francisco 49ers, the football team, and said, but they all sent their recipes, the residents tested them, and then they put the good ones together in a book, which they gave out freely and which they then started selling to make money for their project, all very effective. They started a health promotion resource center, and among other things, they conducted plays on health-related topics to get people talking. The storyline here was that Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was an alcoholic who drank heavily around the holidays. And, you know, in this neighborhood, that story really caught on, and it got a lot of good discussion going. They organized leadership training workshops and media advocacy. That we had reporters come down and teach them how to get your point across when you're dealing with the mass media. They organized to get improved bus transportation, to get hot water turned on in a building that had gone for 10 years without. And this, I remind you, is United States, middle of the 1990s, people going without hot water. They got an out-of-court settlement against a prominent local law school that had owned several buildings and reneged on promised security arrangements, and they got $10,000 out of that law school for going back on their word. Well, we had lots of anecdotal information that this work was having an effect on individual health and well-being. This man was among many who told us that he quit smoking or cut back radically on drinking because the project made him feel they had some control and they could exercise it in their personal lives. We could also document some health changes around specific interventions. For example, we used 24-hour diet recalls to show that people were eating more fresh fruits and vegetables once we started the mini market project. We also hired an outside evaluator who compared health and social outcomes for 150 residents of the hotels we were working in and 150 in those we hadn't been in. And he was able to show changes along 14 dimensions in things like social isolation, morale, perceived ability to make change in your neighborhood, overall quality of life. What he couldn't show, unfortunately, were changes in hard health outcomes, partly because many of the people who made the biggest changes got out of the neighborhood. One guy moved to San Jose and opened a McDonald's. Well, is that a positive health change or a negative? So, seriously, though, many of the changes were very hard to quantify, and I just wanted to end with a story of this guy who, when I first knew him, and he gave me permission to tell his story, was very shy and nervous. He had a serious mental health problem. And every couple of months, he checked himself into the state mental institution for reality orientation. Well, after 2 years, he wasn't doing this anymore. And I asked him about it. And he said, well, Mary, I'm a co-leader of my tenant association. I'm a leader of Tenderloin Tenants for Safer Streets. I'm on the mayor's task force on aging. I just don't have time for reality. Now, it's hard to translate that into a magical chi-square, but these stories, too, are part of the data that we need to collect and share, for they show in the most human and personal terms the value of our community groups and partnerships. Let me leave you with a line from the Australian leader in this work, Ernest Stringer, who likes to say that community-based action research is the search for understanding in the company of friends. I love that line. And as we go forward on our various efforts to make a difference through our community groups and partnerships, I'll reflect back often and warmly on this occasion and on the company of a wonderful group of friends who share a commitment to the power of community for making our societies and our world a better place. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this highlight from the Communities in Control Library. If you did, we'd love you to rate or review this podcast in the iTunes Store and for you to share it with your friends. For further information about Communities in Control, visit communitiesincontrol.com.au.